I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. What a better time to talk about the big issues, the important issues, like social responsibility, than Thanksgiving. What is it? What role does it play in our lives? All of us agree that it sounds good, it's a good idea, but let's take a look at it, break it down, see what it is. We're going to take a look at it from three different perspectives. We're going to look at it actually from the biology, from the personal practice, and from the business side. From the biology side, we're going to talk with Emelina Simon-Thomas. She's from the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley. Later on in the show, we're going to hear from Barbara Shaman. She's the author of Live Your Legacy Now. And later on, we'll hear from Dave Gloss, who's the co-founder and CEO of Here's My Chance. But let's start with the biology. Joining us on the phone is Emelina Simon-Thomas. Emelina Thomas, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure and a privilege. I'm happy to be part of your show.
Thank you. So let's talk about where compassion and altruism live in the brain.
Oh, that's such a wonderful question. So it's a little bit more complicated than a one structure or a one region answer. Essentially, our brains have a lot of different areas that all work in concert in a parallel and distributed fashion. But what we do know is that there are systems in the brain that are dedicated to supporting what we might call care and nurturance functions. And this is that what parents do for their offspring in our human species as well as many other species. And then we know that there are systems in the brain that represent pleasure and reward. And it turns out that to the extent that we take opportunities to be kind and generous and serve others, we more readily activate both of those systems, the care-nurturance system and the pleasure and reward systems. And to the extent that those systems get frequently and regularly activated, we're healthier, happier people. So there's this interesting kind of synergistic spiral. The more time we spend investing in the well-being of others, the more pleasure we feel, and the more we activate that both of those systems, the happier and healthier we feel, the longer we live, the better sort of sense of safety and social connection we have. So it's just one of these kind of untapped into secrets to the good life that we at the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley are really trying to remind people of their potential and capacity for.
I got to give you a plug, though. The Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley is you've got just a great web page, and I consult it very, very, very often. I also want to bring up the negative side, though. You know, all of this compassion sounds great, and we see how and why it works, but somehow, in general, what I'm seeing is generosity and compassion get inhibited in our lives. We humans tend to be less compassionate than we're born with.
Well, you know, one of the problems is probably cultural, right? As a society, the Western industrial cultures have kind of adopted a very individualistic strike out on your own and pioneer your own good life. And that's really all you need to do in order to achieve happiness at some future time. And sadly, that's very sort of entrenched in our psychological milieu. Another piece of it is that, indeed, we're also built with systems for sort of self-preservation, right? We do need to not expire unnecessarily. And so we have systems that help us stay vigilant to threats, and then we have systems that help us connect with others and open our hearts and minds to other opportunities. And those things sort of work in reciprocity with one another. So if you're feeling very distressed or anxious or self-conscious or concerned about your worth or your capacity to serve in a particular moment, you're less available to attune to what's going on around you, and that's including being empathic or noticing other people. All of that sort of gets inhibited by feeling anxious or distressed, and we've set up a very busy, time-sensitive kind of life for ourselves here. So the more we're worried that we're going to be late or we haven't done well or we haven't achieved the particular goal that we mean to have achieved by this point in our life, or perhaps we're feeling inadequate about some other aspiration, the less we're able to reach out and connect and engage those caregiving circuits.
Sounds like the more the focus of our lens is internal, the worse it is. I had the experience several years ago with a patient who was severely depressed, couldn't take medications. She was having these terrible side effects, and she got so bad she had to leave work before she lost her job. And that's a dangerous thing for anybody who's depressed to leave the structure in their lives. And I told her the only way I would agree to this would be if she would volunteer 20 hours a week to help sentient beings, you know, animals, children, elderly, homeless, whoever. And she did. And, of course, her mood improved significantly. And the most interesting part of this to me was then she tried antidepressants again, and she was having fewer side effects. So consistent with what you're saying, Emelina, that all this helping, being helpful to others, actually changed her body chemistry.
Well, I think that that's a tremendous anecdote that really sort of fleshes out the story that we're trying to tell scientifically. Indeed, you know, the extent to which you engage these caregiving, nurturance, generosity circuits in the brain and in the body, you know, one of the main systems in the body, which my colleague Dacher Keltner frequently talks about and has done some of the most important work on scientifically, is the vagus nerve. And so the vagus nerve is really important for sort of calming the body and also supporting what we call affiliative functions. And so to the extent to which we affiliate with others, we're also sort of strengthening our capacity for what you might call contentment. And then contentment, in turn, makes us more able to utilize other parts of our nervous system that are committed to empathizing, to giving care and nurturance to others, et cetera. So again, there's this kind of really synergistic relationship between generosity and caregiving and one's own sort of stability, emotional stability in life. And so your story really does kind of explain that quite nicely. So thank you for sharing that.
I want to talk a little bit more about this vagus nerve. And by the way, that's V-A-G-U-S.
It's V-A-G-U-S, and it's the 10th cranial nerve.
And it's not V-E-G. It's not Las Vegas.
V-A-G-U-S, vagus.
It's not Las Vegas. It's a whole different nerve.
No, yeah.
But, you know,
thankfully it's spelled a little differently, so we don't get them mixed up.
You talked about contentment being associated mm-hmm. with this nerve. Isn't that ultimately what we're all looking for? I mean, we talk about happiness and the pursuit of happiness, but ultimately, aren't we looking for well-being? Just a sense of well-being?
It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful idea, and it's one that came up recently when I had the opportunity to engage in a sort of workshop/conference with several people who are experts in the contemplative Tibetan tradition, and we were talking about the ideas of happiness and harmony and consciousness, and when I explained what I thought happiness meant and sort of the greater good's perspective on happiness, what they said was, you know what, you're not talking about happiness, you're talking about contentment. Mm-hmm. And in many realms, sure, we can have a semantic back and forth, but if it takes redefining happiness to mean something other than pleasure and having your needs instantaneously met, then that's what we need to do, because unfortunately most people sort of hear contentment and they think it sounds sort of boring, right? Whereas happiness sounds great. So let's just, you know, work on thinking about how we define happiness and perhaps allowing it to involve and include some of these other more nuanced emotional experiences that are involved in contentment, you know, being able to recover quickly from negative states, but having them, right? Happiness isn't all about joy and pleasure all the time. It's very important to experience sadness, to experience anger when you're in the face of injustice, and to have it motivate some kind of clever and effective response to something like that. So we need these negative emotions. They're here for our survival. We just need to relate to them in a healthier way than we typically do.
Well, you know, the heart and soul of the Greater Good Science Center is, well, I don't want to say the heart and soul, but it's awful lot about gratitude, and that's the underpinning of an awful lot of these shifts. And we're going to be talking about gratitude later in the show. But, I mean, I know you have been seeing, I've been seeing all sorts of viral email or Facebook posts about listing what we are grateful for. There's a huge difference between naming things and actually feeling grateful.
That I would agree with that wholeheartedly, and it's kind of a baby step scenario. I do absolutely love gratitude, and the reason I do is because it's so universally accessible. There isn't a kind of a religious or spiritual tone to it that's specific. Many and most thinkers, and even people who would call themselves atheists, actually, you know, can relate to gratitude and appreciate that perhaps it's something that's valuable in their own personal and in their social lives. The pioneering research on gratitude involves something called a gratitude journal, which, as you described, was listing down, you know, 3 to 5 things that you're grateful for. When I think about gratitude, I think that the most powerful version of it is being grateful to a person. And when you're expressing gratitude about a person, what you need to sort of include in that expression is, you know, what they did, acknowledge how much effort they put into it, and sort of describe the impact it had on your life. And when you do those three things, it's like supercharging gratitude. And other wonderful studies in gratitude use something called the gratitude letter, where someone is encouraged to sit down and write about an experience of gratitude for a person, and then actually to call them up or try to arrange a meeting with them where you actually share and read the letter to them. And this is shown to be a more powerful, positive impact than simply the listing three things. So it's kind of us to embody these experiences a little bit more deeply than perhaps just kind of, like you said, the off-the-cuff listing might achieve.
Right. And, in addition to gratitude to someone, I often feel gratitude for someone and for
Absolutely.
So many people. And, that's something I'm able to hold and carry with me when I allow myself to wake up and be conscious, which
Absolutely.
Happens rarely.
Well, rarely is better than never.
Oh, you're so good. Listen, I know you have to go. You've got a time schedule, and we're gonna take a short break now and talk with Barbara Shaman. Emmeline, I want to thank you so much for taking the time.
It's been a total pleasure, and thank you so much for being flexible. And have a wonderful holiday season. Enjoy your friends and family and community around you. And don't get sucked into the vortex of materialistic consumerism.
No.
We can do so much better just being grateful for what's right in front of us.
Yes.
And there is so much to be grateful for. So thank you.
Sure
thank you
is.
For this opportunity.
Emmeline, please take care.
You too. Thank you.
That was Emmeline Simon Thomas, who's with the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley. It's a great, great organization. Well, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Barbara Shaman. She's the author of Live Your Legacy Now and founder of the companion organization Embrace Your Legacy Now. We'll be back in 60 seconds. We're talking about the greater good, what we can do to make the world a better place, and how we can actually live our legacy rather than talking about it. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. What are you doing to make the world a better place? Do you feel like you can do anything, or do you feel powerless about it? 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The foundation encourages everyone to participate in Giving Tuesday on December 2nd by supporting nonprofits on the day after Cyber Monday. Every day is Giving Tuesday at the Philadelphia Foundation, where $20 million in grants and scholarships support 1,000 nonprofits annually thanks to donors like you. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at IamConcerned.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about social responsibility. Nah, I don't like that word. We're talking about social opportunity and how we fit into the larger world and really our relationship with it. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking now with Barbara Shaman. I had mentioned before the break, she's the author of Live Your Legacy Now. She's also the creator of Champions of Caring, an organization dedicated to helping young people improve their communities. Barbara, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.
For joining us today. You said in the opening pages of your book that if people could use their passion, skills and life lesson to make the world a better place, that they would. I want to talk about your life lessons to begin with. And it begins with your parents' history. Your mother was in Auschwitz. Your father worked for Oskar Schindler. That's quite a legacy. Tell us a little bit about them and what they taught you through words and through action.
Well, thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my passion with you today and to reflect upon the impact that my family's history has had on my life. My mother, even though she was just a teenager during World War II, would share with me that when she was in the Lodz ghetto, she took care of orphans. She was 15 years old, but saw it as an opportunity to give back and said to me growing up, and even under the worst of circumstances, one can try to make the world a better place and hold on to their humanity. My grandmother found berries in Auschwitz and rouged the cheeks of frail elderly women to sustain them yet for another day. So again, I learned that under the worst, most heinous opportunities that life can confront you with, you can make a difference. And my father, on the death march, carried his cousin who was dying of typhus on his back. So I was born into a family that thought that being a mensch, a good, kind, caring, compassionate human being, was the most important thing that one can be. And I was raised with this notion of every day my mother would ask me, was I a mensch today? And what did I do in my peer group to put a smile on someone's face, to help out, to reach out? When I was growing up, my father and his friends would take whatever amount of money they could afford each month and send it to Oskar Schindler out of gratitude for having saved them. So very early, I learned about giving back and philanthropy and that everyone has an opportunity to make a difference.
You grew up in this country, essentially.
Yes, I was born in Europe after the war.
And you were here when you were a baby.
3 years old.
Yeah, it's a baby by my definition.
Me too.
So you grew up in a world where people were self-focused. I mean, the world didn't look that way at their children, at their world, the connection with the larger world. Didn't you want to rebel against this? What about me?
You know, it's interesting. I've been asked that question a lot. But I grew up in the Washington Heights section of New York, and all of my friends were survivors and children of survivors.
Right, right.
So that was my norm. And I took it as the way the world works, that you have to be a mensch, you have to give back, you have to look at how can I make someone's day a better day. And then there was the other piece, which Helen Epstein talked about in her book, being a nachas machine for my parents. Which
What's that mean?
It means that as the daughter or child of survivors, it was our job to put out joy for them, as if by doing well in school, doing wonderful things with our lives would ease the pain of what they had suffered.
That can go either way.
Yes.
And I know many, many children of survivors and children of any parent who've gone through terrible, terrible childhoods, that you can do it as an act of love for them, or you can do it as a burden and responsibility. And depending on where you're focused, that can compromise your life or it can enhance it.
I agree with that. I was very blessed to have the most optimistic, wonderful, giving mother as a role model. And she so inspired me to look at a life where I can give back and make a difference as an empowerment tool, that by making other people's lives better, I'm essentially making my own better. And that was one of the lessons she taught me.
So let's take a leap here. You mentioned your father, and that he worked for Oscar Schindler. You met Steven Spielberg, who was the creator of Schindler's List, among many others. You were inspired after that meeting, was it, to create Champions of Caring?
Well, what happened, Dan, was I went to Auschwitz with my parents and 100 Holocaust survivors in 1989, and walking through that horrific place, I realized that I needed to do something with my life that would really show myself that I understood what happens when people lose their humanity. And I thought if I could work with youth and engage them in doing projects for social change and to celebrate their pro-social behaviors like kindness and caring and compassion and put a premium on those values. Because I think, Dan, too frequently we only look at academics or athletics. And my piece was, what about the heart? What if we could celebrate young people who really demonstrate these behaviors? And right in Auschwitz with my mother, we talked about my trying to do something here in Philadelphia to engage young people in service and to train teachers in looking for these skill sets in young people and celebrate them for being good, kind people and creating cultures of caring in schools. I then met Steven Spielberg, shared this with him, and he then helped me through his Righteous Persons Foundation, which I'm very, very grateful for.
Hmm. You described in Champions of Carings in your book, you've got some great stories about what students have done in their neighborhoods. I'm going to give you a couple of stories. I don't know if you're going to remember them off the top of your head. One story is Celine, who lost her grandfather and wanted to honor his memory. Could you tell us about her?
Well, Celine was a very dedicated young woman. She went to one of the archdiocesan schools, and she could hear her grandfather's voice in her head. And I understand that because my mother passed away 3 years ago and I still feel her spirit and hear her in my head. And she decided that in honor of her grandfather, she needed to do good things because that would keep the connection and make him really proud. And, you know, in your first segment, you talked about the legacy letters that I call, you know, writing to people, even if they're dead, or, you know, thinking about, I know for me on Thanksgiving, I will think a lot about my mother and the influence she had on me and take it as a time of reflection to think about who touched my life deeply, who helped me become the person that I want to be, and am I fulfilling that role? So sometimes in memory of someone you loved, you can really be motivated to do incredible things.
I want to, you know, mention 15-year-old Stephanie, who noticed that elementary school students in her inner city neighborhood were being promoted from one grade to the next without really knowing how to read on that grade level. What did she do about this?
Stephanie was a very charismatic, strong young woman who said to me, it's hard enough to be black in this country, but if you're black and you cannot read, that's the end for you. And she undertook getting 300 students together in the afternoons and created a literacy core where she not only got the students to come, but adults to come and help them learn how to read. And I put Stephanie on a stage with President Bush when he came to Philadelphia to talk about the importance of service. And she was so articulate and so passionate because she knew that no matter what your socioeconomic circumstance, no matter what background you came from, if you have passion in your heart and a plan, you can make a difference.
Okay. Passion. Mm-hmm. So nothing proceeds unless we find out what we're really passionate about. Otherwise, we're rote here. So these days, many people I meet don't have passion about much of anything other than to go to work, take care of their kids, go to sleep, and repeat the same thing the next day. So how do somebody find passion if they can't feel it inside?
Well, I do a lot of speaking, and I share stories of some of these young people and people that I've worked with and my own story. And sometimes that can ignite a spark in someone. But I like to say to people, so what is your life about? And what would you really want it to be about? And what would you want to have happen in your life that you care about deeply?
We went too fast. What is your life about?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of answers do you get?
It's about my family. It's about my work. It's about a sport or travel or what I love. So frequently it's a compilation of those kinds of things.
Uh-huh. And what from there?
And from there, are there areas that you care about? I understand you love all of those pieces, but is there something in your heart or is there an issue that really upsets you that you would want to make a change about? And it's interesting, when I speak to groups, people will start thinking about, what can I do around something that's important to me? For instance, I once had a mother jump up after a speech that I gave and said, you know, I am passionate about my son who has Down syndrome, and he really doesn't have a lot of skills, but I love to cook. What if I could teach him and some of his friends basic cooking skills so that he can take care of himself? And that's putting that kind of what I call legacy formula in front of people. What's something you love? Like Stephanie loved black young people, and what was she angry about? That they couldn't read. By combining these two things, she was able to make a difference.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Yeah, Emelina, in the first segment, talked about anger. Anger is a reaction to injustice. And that's what anger is. More often than not, anger is a reaction to injustice. I call it a judicial emotion. So if you're angry in reaction to injustice, anger is passion.
Yeah.
Anger is an emotion of great passion.
Well, Dan, the anger that when I was walking through Auschwitz and mm-hmm. I knew that my mother and my grandmother were incarcerated there, that fury pushed me to start Champions of Caring.
Why not bitterness? Why didn't it turn to poison?
Because
it does. You know it does.
I know it does, but my mother taught me that if you're angry, you do something positive about it because bitterness will erode your soul.
And why doesn't anger, as we often hear, turn to helplessness? And that's going to take us right back to what can we do? I mean, you look at the larger world and, you know, there's hunger. There's extraordinary violence. There's inhumanity. There's hatred against all sorts of people of different colors, religions, even geographies in the world. There's climate change that's threatening to kill the whole planet. It's overwhelming. I mean, you watch the news. It's overwhelming. And a lot of people, all you want to do is turn the TV off and go read a book or watch a movie and not deal with this.
You know, what I've discovered in my own life is that the greater meaning and purpose I have in my life the more content, I will use that word after hearing your initial interview, I am about who I am as a person. And knowing that government cannot take care of all the issues, I know that people need to step up to the plate. And one thing that a myth that I want to diffuse is that you don't have to be an Oprah Winfrey or a Bill Gates to change the world. If Stephanie could do it at the age of 14, people can really do this. But it's really a matter of being reflective about, what do I care about? If I could change something, what would it be?
How does it start? What's the first step?
The first step is really looking at your core values. What are you about? What's important to you? And really reflecting on, I'm on this earth for a finite amount of time. What can I do to contribute? And even when I work in schools with kids who are 12, 13, 14, I come at it with, what do you love? What do you love to do? And Raul says, salsa dancing. What do you not like? I don't like old white people who don't like Puerto Rican and black boys and cross the street when they see them. Raul, create a project marrying these two ideas. And what Raul did is got 20 Latino and African-American boys to go to a senior center and teach the salsa to 80 and 90-year-olds. Mm. And from that blossomed a beautiful friendship, which turned attitudes of negativity into bonds of caring and compassion. So it's that formula has worked for a lot of people. What do you want to do? If you love cooking the way that first woman in the story mm-hmm. does, teach. I have a friend, Margie, whom I adore, and Margie loves to knit. And she created something called Care Squares. She did it with her mother, and she made afghans for young women in halfway houses to add joy to their lives, which have been pretty impoverished. So whatever it is that you love, and whatever it is you can change with that love, that's the beginning of thinking about it. And if you don't have the passion and the idea, maybe you can be part of a legacy group, which is a concept I share.
What is that?
A legacy group is getting a group of like-minded people together. It can be done intergenerationally, which I love, when generation 1, 2, and 3 can sit at a Thanksgiving table and talk about what do we love and what can we do as a family to make a change. Or it could be done in the corporate world and create that kind of culture of caring we need in the business world as well. It could be done in your faith-based community. Or once I had a group of women who used to meet once a month for lunch and just chat. Now they meet once a month for lunch and they create their projects. And sometimes it's one woman's idea and the other people bring their talents to the table. If they need a budget, one of the women might do that piece. If they need someone to put some stuff on social media, another woman takes that role. So maybe not everyone in the group has the same passion, but they can contribute to the success of the project.
Well, on that note, and I want to tell, we're going to take a break. I want to tell our callers, I've been very selfish with you, and I haven't gone to the phones. I promise I will right after this break. But I want to ask you, our listeners, what are you passionate about? What's your legacy? Are you involved in making the world a better place or not? And if you're not, what stops you? There's something inside that stops you. Maybe the big question that we hear from Barbara, the big question here is, what is your life about? We don't usually take the time to ask these questions. What is my life about? And in the 30, 40, 50, 60 years we have left, what do we want to do with that life, really? Well, we'll come back. Oh, by the way, I should give you the numbers if I'm asking all these questions, huh? 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Barbara Shaman, author of Live Your Legacy Now. We'll also be joined by Dave Gloss. He's the co-founder and CEO of Here's My Chance, a branding, communication, and design firm for social enterprises. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Dr. Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute. Wistar proudly supports WHYY and announces the opening of its new 7-story Robert and Penny Fox Tower, designed to accelerate scientific discoveries. Here, Wistar scientists are working together on a new flu vaccine designed to eliminate the need for an annual flu shot and save thousands of lives in the process. Learn more about this and other advances at Wistar.org. The Wistar Institute, today's discoveries, tomorrow's cures.
The latest healthcare developments.
How what happens in Washington affects you.
How world events affect us all.
The news continues throughout your day. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. We are your co-hosts for Here and Now. Breaking news, thoughtful analysis, surprising interviews in the middle of your day.
With voices from all across the country so you won't miss a thing.
That's Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. As promised, we're talking with Barbara Shaman, author of Live Your Legacy Now. We're also joined on the phone by Dave Gloss, co-founder and CEO of Here's My Chance, a branding, communication, and design firm for social enterprises. So, Dave, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So you and I are in vastly different generations. Yeah, it's funny for you, maybe. But so a branding, communication, and design for social enterprises. Could you translate that for me, please?
Absolutely. So the type of work that we do with Here's My Chance is to support this growing community of what you call do-gooders. You know, traditionally, organizations that would go out into the world and do good work would be nonprofits. You can understand that. But there's this increasing demographic of for-profit entities, B corporations, and corporate social responsibility programs that are out there that are growing and getting more people involved. And we've chosen to exclusively work with those types of groups to help raise awareness, create the campaigns to get people to pay attention and get more involved and to support the causes that matter to them.
Like Barbara, your parents introduced you to the idea of social responsibility. Yes?
Oh, yes, absolutely. My folks, they ran a charity called Careless International for about 20 years, and that's the only world that I grew up in. You know, from the time I was a young child, everything that I knew is your responsibility on this planet is to make a contribution. And, you know, when I graduated college, actually, I remember asking my dad, I was like, Dad, I want to come work for you. And he says, well, what can you do? And I said, well, nothing really yet. And he said, listen, there are a lot of great people with passion in their hearts to do good work. But the business side of doing good is still something that needs to be strengthened. So go fill your toolbox. And when you're ready, come back and apply business rigor to impact. And we chose to do it here at Here's My Chance on the communication side. I think when you can share a message that people can really feel authentic and connected to, you know, that's what, you know, gets them to get up and to get involved. Like Raul, you know, he was able to connect that story of my challenge and my passion and make something of that. And that's on the micro scale. We try and do that on the macro scale.
So how would you help Raul, for example? How would you help Raul or one of the other people in Barbara's program, Champions of Caring, get it on a bigger scale?
Yeah, I think with Raul's case, I think it's an excellent program. The type of work that we do at Here's My Chance is to understand what's that core message, what's that call to action, what's that nuance that people don't understand or could be called to, and to harness that message and to identify the ways we want to put that out, whether it's building out a website that's going to be able to allow people to sign up. Say there are retirement communities looking for really creative social and community programs, entertaining programs that they could sign up for, as well as designing the graphics that once things are a year from now, and Raul's worked with 13 programs, you know, how do we share that so we can get people to pay more attention? Like, what are the results? What's the impact? Because I think the challenge that a lot of, you know, social ventures and nonprofits deal with is they have great work, but communicating the scale of it is what, so that's where it stops. I think that, you know, being able to arm those individuals and those organizations with the resources to say, hey, we've done such great work for 3+ years. how do we find the funds or the supporters to be able to continue and spread it beyond? Because I can't just do it alone.
Well, I'm sitting here listening to you talk, as is Barbara Shaman, and I'm watching her reaction, and she just has a look on her face of somebody who's loving what she's hearing. Yes, Barbara?
Yes, because I think what you're talking about, impact, is really critical. Many people are serial volunteers, which is fine. But I think if you really want to make sustainable and impactful change, you really need a plan. And when we work with the youth here in the city of Philadelphia, we train their teachers in our model where we talk about impact. People need to have goals and objectives and a mission statement. They need to have a timeline. They need to understand who their community partners are. They need to be able to reflect on success or failure and how they might change an aspect of their program. So I'm loving what you're saying, because this is teaching young people skill sets that will empower them to be successful leaders, to do well in school, go on to college, and be successful in their careers as well. So I think the branding that you're talking about and really taking this to scale is a wonderful thing that you're doing, and I love that it's all these generations. I'm baby boomer and you're a millennial, and I'm working with kids in schools, that we can bring everyone together, because I feel strongly an intergenerational approach to service is the best way to go.
And we also learned in the beginning of the show that it's the healthiest way to go for our brains, not just our communities and our relationships. Let's go to the phones. I promised we'd get some callers on. We've got Katie on the line. Hi, Katie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What can we do for you?
Well, I just wanted to thank you, first of all, for having this segment. I think it is so inspiring to hear the stories of all those young people. And I think that I can resonate with some of the stories as well. I'm the daughter of a survivor in a different kind of sense. My father was hit by a car, and he suffered traumatic brain injury where he lost his ability to speak. But through music and through certain types of therapies, he was actually able to regain his speech. And so now I've taken my passion for music and for people with developmental disabilities, and I work with individuals in music therapy with developmental disabilities. Specifically, I have a group of individuals mostly with Down syndrome. They're called the Joy Bells. I work alongside Sue Graves at Melmark, Pennsylvania. And the Joy Bells are a bell choir with mostly individuals with Down syndrome. And actually, we have the great opportunity of playing with the Philadelphia Chamber Orchestra this December 7th at the Hamilton. And it's through music that we're able to share these people's gifts, because they're there. Sometimes they just need a little bit more help to unlock them. And I really believe that music has the ability to do that. So I feel so thankful for the opportunity that I have to do that.
Well, thank you. And thanks so much for your call. You know, Barbara, Katie and you and I, to a certain extent, our job is to unlock people's passions, and Dave, your job is to be able to help them grow and brand them.
Yeah, it's all part of a really interesting ecosystem, and it's so funny, full circle here. I was listening earlier to the segment with the Greater Good Science Center, and we did an infographic for them about a year ago, which took one of their really dense reports that was really well written but also very long, and turned it into something that people can take action on. You know, what are the impacts of gratitude on longevity of life, on interpersonal relationships and things like that? And you know, to your point of scale and getting people to engage with it, you know, those type of messages and pieces allow people to continue and and to still feel passionate about it even after they've done it. That's why, you know, pictures, things like that are just so good to commemorate throughout the programs.
What actually, I've got to tell you this, Dave. Both my producer, and Larry Roebling and I both are involved in nonprofits that we both feel very passionate about. Larry with a musical group, I'm with the Boys and Girls Club in Camden, New Jersey, and we're both fighting over you to get a video and branding and to get our programs more publicity so we could get funding. So we might just cut you in half and
I'll take a piece.
Yeah. Oh, in thirds now. Barbara's taking a piece too.
Well, there's eight of us over here, and we're doubling down in Philadelphia. This is our home, and there's such an ecosystem of those similar like-minded people. You know, I'm actually at the Impact Hub, is where our office is at 4th and Girard, and I'm looking through this glass of our small conference room. Literally, right now, there are 70 people lined up on a Thanksgiving table, expressing gratitude for each other for the type of work that we're doing. There is this growing ecosystem of hungry and committed social entrepreneurs and leaders that, you know, not just here's my chance, but like many folks that have the skills to share to help raise awareness for other groups. So it's an exciting time to be in Philly for this.
As a matter of fact, and I'll say to both of you, you know, I just filled out my application for the Give an Hour campaign for a psychotherapist to donate an hour of psychotherapy to you know, returning vets with PTSD. So there's all sorts of ways to take what we're passionate about and our skill set and help make people feel better.
I like that you share that, particularly because some people think it's so overwhelming. And you can commit in small ways, and they can grow. You don't have to just jump right in or create a 501c3, but you can start thinking about, if I have an hour a month.
Don't start a 501c3.
Right.
Yeah, well, I did that, and, you know, you got to.
Oh, no. So we have this saying here. It's like every good idea deserves to be a project or a program, but not every good idea needs to be a 501c3.
Absolutely. And I like that a lot. But if people could think on a smaller scale, maybe once a month, and then grow it and get the great feeling, because what I've learned over the years, the more you give to others, the more you get for yourself.
Boy, that's so true. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Shyam on the line. Shyam, did I pronounce your name correctly? Do we have you? Hello?
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 Hi.
What can we do for you?
Is that Dan Gottlieb?
It is.
Okay, my name is Shyam G, and I was very touched by, I'm actually a listener of yours whenever I find time.
Thank you.
At any rate, I was very touched by the program on contentment. And I discovered one thing, that in order to be really content, we have to learn to know the difference between me and I. I was very inspired by Socrates. I was a student of philosophy, by the way. So he said, know thyself. And then that was a statement that got me for the rest of my life.
Well,
to the degree that I am still teaching people how to do that. I have a nonprofit organization here in Pennsylvania, in New Hope. And I'm teaching people how to make a distinction between I, the self, and me, the body, the object.
Yeah, well, I have to tell you, right after that, I mean, you know, we've got the Buddha a few generations later, and the Buddha is famous for having said that you can summarize all my teachings into one sentence, and that's disavow things that begin with I, me, or mine. So you just change focus outward on helping others. I want to focus on something that you said, Barbara, that we don't have to start with a big project. So let's say I'm concerned about world hunger. Mm-hmm. It's big and it's getting worse and I can't tolerate it. And right around this radio station here, how many hundreds of people within a few small blocks are hungry now? What can I do about that?
Well, I'm happy the way you phrase that, because we can't cure world hunger, but we can look in our own community and maybe create a community garden. because a lot of the indigent communities don't have fruits and vegetables and don't have access to them. Some people have to take two buses to get to a supermarket from their neighborhood to acquire these kinds of foods. So we can really look at working collaboratively right in our own community and making a difference. Really looking at cafeteria food, I think, is such a big issue. What are our kids eating in our schools?
I want to go beyond looking at, though.
And roll your sleeves up and get involved.
Mm-hmm.
Dig into that garden. You know, there are people who want to write a check and target the check. And if that's all they want to do, that's great. We need the money. But if you can also roll up your sleeves and get vested in the project and dig in the dirt and then come and work with the kids in the school, the greatest satisfaction I found is when you're actually relating to the people that you're working with. And I don't see this as charity, Dan. This is very important point to me, because there for the grace of God go I. I saw what happened to my family when a world went crazy and the rest of the world stood by silent and indifferent. I get such pleasure when I can deliver the goods to the people. My daughter and her children a few years ago at Christmastown found out about a woman who had a baby under horrific circumstances and didn't have a layette. They decided to take their money for presents and buy the layette and then go deliver it to the home. That really touched me, that you reach outside of yourself and your own needs and look, can I add joy to someone else? So getting hands-on with a project is key. It will give you satisfaction beyond any monetary amount you could ever envision. So I say, get people around you who are like-minded, who are not naysayers and will, you know, knock the project down, and come up with a plan. And really look at what are my goals and then my objectives, who do I need on this team to make it happen, and then start in small steps but dream in technicolor.
You've been doing this for a long time. And this passion is unabated in you. You can hear it in the tone in your voice and the look in your eye when you talk about it. It's just wonderful to watch. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Dave Gloss, thanks so much for what you do. We're going to be up there in a couple of hours, and we're going to cut you guys up and divvy up the goods. Barbara Shaman, thank you. Your book is Live Your Legacy Now, and I highly, highly recommend this book. It's just terrific. And please check out Champions of Caring. It's a great organization. Well, earlier on, we heard from Emelina Simon-Thomas. She was from the Greater Good Science Center. Well, you can follow us on Twitter at Voices in the Fam, email us at voices@whyy.org, and you can find me at drdangottlieb.com. You can hear about my upcoming lectures and courses that I'm teaching. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Adam Staniszewski. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is back. She's our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Lindsay Carfagno is our intern. Larry Roebling produces the show. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Please enjoy your week.